A very warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time, in which we shall be discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guest, I should mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom. So if you do hear a few noises off, you'll know why. So helping us in our explorations today is Bernadette Mercier-Aspiteri. Bernadette holds a BA Hons and an MSc from the University of Sheffield and is currently senior executive at the Superintendence of Cultural Heritage. Her speciality is the analysis of human remains from archaeological contexts and excavating ancient funerary sites. So Bernadette will be explaining to us, hopefully, and I'm sure she'll do it really beautifully, the importance of bones in archaeology. So, Ben, if I may, that's how I usually refer to you, sir. On to my first question. Sounds like an obvious question, but I'm sure it's quite complicated. What are bones made of, really?
Hello, Patricia. Thank you for inviting me to your program. Yes, bones are quite in fact complicated. First of all, they're treated as a connective tissue, just like other parts of the body. But they are made up of protein, in particular collagen, and also mineral. And they're special. The special thing about these bones is that they're a living tissue and they are able to repair and also reshape themselves with responses such as trauma, for example. They have many functions. Obviously, the most obvious perhaps function is that the bones allow movement for the body. And they are the anchor points to muscles, tendons, and also ligaments. But the bones also have other important functions. First of all, they protect certain organs. For example, if you can imagine the rib cage, the ribs are protecting some very vital organs embedded in the body. But they also act as centers for blood cell production, for instance, or even reservoirs for minerals such as calcium. As we said before, bones are very dynamic, so they allow growth. This is why we have, obviously, the skeleton changes as the person develops in life. And they vary as well a lot from population to population, but also between individuals, making our job a bit exciting, maybe a bit harder as well when we're doing analysis.
Yes, I can imagine. Every individual must be, as you say, an individual, even if they are part of a group. In archaeology, turning to the archaeological side, in archaeological contexts, where does one find bones, and what are the best conditions for the survival of skeletal remains?
Usually, bones are found in funerary contexts, so cemeteries or churches. If we're talking about medieval times or more recent times, but even in the past. So when we talk about the prehistoric period or Punic times or Roman times, there used to be designated areas for burial. These could be individual graves underground, hewn out of the rock, or as clusters of tombs. Again, usually hewn out of the rock when we're talking about the prehistoric and up to the Roman periods. And obviously, the idea is to have an underground space for remains to be placed and reusing them as time passes. We also have larger complexes, even within the prehistoric period, such as the Hypogeum or the Shara stone circle in Gozo. And also in the Roman period, late Roman, early Christian period, we have catacombs, for instance, again hewn out of the rock. Occasionally, we do get the odd bone coming out in other circumstances. Sometimes we find caves or natural cavities, which we know the Maltese Islands are have various features of the sort. And sometimes they relate to prehistoric times, but even later periods. And sometimes the odd bone just crops up, even in fields. And this could either be an indication that there's a cemetery close by and there's runoff bone with water movement, or else perhaps that and the bone happens to be in the soil, which has been moved from a cemetery or from a place of burial. Bone is quite resilient. It survives in a lot of conditions. Of course, if it's, for instance, waterlogged, it can deteriorate a lot. In fact, we've excavated a recent tomb which seemed to have been waterlogged and the bone was very fragile. But in those circumstances, we try to work with conservators who can help us get the bone perhaps in a better condition so that we can handle it and examine it a bit better. But on the whole, it's quite resilient.
I was thinking of Otsi, or those sometimes in these marshy places they find in the peat bogs, they find they look like mummified figures, so that they're leathery. Would any bone remain in those circumstances?
In some circumstances, in fact, with the bog bodies, the bone does not survive very well. It's actually the soft tissues which preserve. So the muscles, the skin, even some organs remain as well. We don't have those type of situations in Malta because of the environment we have. But definitely, that is something which is found even in Northern Europe, where they have to treat, obviously, the human remains in a different way. They're processed through CT scanning, for instance, and other treatments to preserve them.
One of the interesting, obviously, I would imagine the main work that you do is finding out what the bones can really tell you at various levels. How do you actually go about getting that information from the bones? What options are open to you?
There is a lot of information you can get out from bones. I think one of the first things an osteologist does is wanting to identify how many bones there are in an assemblage which they are studying, and also trying to understand how many people are within your assemblage. Usually, many a times, it's not, you don't just find a skeleton, an intact skeleton in anatomical position. Many times the bones are fragmented, they are jumbled, and therefore in the assemblage there will be more than one individual, even adults, children, all mixed together. So when an osteologist is faced with an assemblage, that's the first thing that happens, an inventory of bone to identify how many individuals. The next stage would be to understand whether you have adults and children. And the way you separate the bone to understand who you have in your assemblage is by, firstly, with adults, you know that the bone is developed. So you know you have a fully developed bone. But you can also see whether you have older adults or younger adults. And there are some elements in the skeleton that can give us these clues, in particular the cranium and also the pelvic bones. With age, an adult's bones wear down. So there are certain morphological changes to the surface of the bone. And you make comparisons with established methods. Methods which are based on human remains with known ages. so we know exactly how the skeleton changes through age. With children, it's a bit easier. A child's skeleton develops very fast and usually at specific ages. So you compare almost any bone within the skeleton of a young child in particular, and you measure the bone, and you can tell a very tight age range to identify when the child has died. Then we can use methods also with regards to identifying the sex, in particular adults. And again, we use the pelvic bones and the cranial bones for those. The reason is that the cranial bones of a male is normally more robust than that of a female. So there we can see, we can try and estimate the sex in that sense. But the pelvic bones, specifically of the female, are usually of a certain shape to allow for childbirth. So there we have certain specific dimorphism when it comes to males and females. Something we look at also is the pathology. This is obviously something very interesting because it can tell us a lot about the trend of diseases in the past, but also aspects such as diet, for instance. And it can tell us also how a population has treated certain diseases or trauma, such as fractures to the bones. So we learn a lot from that, from these trends. There are other things as well. I mean, we can look at, for instance, stature of an individual by measuring long bones. And so that can tie also with diet. We can look at pathologies affecting the teeth in particular, which can indicate also diet and what they are eating in specifically, or how they're using their mouth in their daily activities. And we can do even further testing. Further testing can range from assessing the DNA of the individual, which then gives us an indication of populations, because obviously we know that different populations have different DNA markers, in particular in the past. That can give us an indication of people coming into the Maltese Islands, for instance, if we have different communities coming in.
About the DNA, I'm fascinated because obviously this is a fairly recent new tool for the toolkit of an archaeologist. How easy is it actually in a context where the remains perhaps are damaged, as you were describing before? How easy is it to actually obtain DNA from bones?
Unfortunately, in our climate with humidity, it's not very easy to find bone which is good enough, in good condition for a DNA. But still we have tried, and we have reached some successes, even in the prehistoric period. The older the bone is, the more degraded the DNA usually is. So if we're finding some DNA in prehistoric period, it's quite good in our context due to the humidity we have here. But before we take samples, we always assess the bone in full, especially with the people, with the experts doing the testing abroad. Obviously, the testing implies taking a sample for destructive analysis. So we always have to be cautious and assess really well whether it is worth doing the testing or not. Definitely, it's a field which is improving as years go by. And we're hoping to achieve more, to do more tests on Maltese samples, because I think being in the center of the Mediterranean, I think it's a very important type of test in order to understand movements and mobility of populations even outside Malta.
Which out of the 206 bones in the body, and I looked that up, let's check that I got it right, would you prefer to find in an excavating in an excavation situation? Which would be the ones that would really, I mean, you've mentioned the importance of the pelvic bones for sexing the different, but I'm sure there are other bones that are useful to you.
This is quite a tough one because as osteologists, we love all bones. So it's a bit, we think they're all precious. But if I really had to choose one, I'd choose, well, the cranium, which is actually a set of bones together. So I'm actually cheating in that sense. But I think the cranium would be on the top of the list. And the reason is that you can get so much information from the cranium, from sex, as we mentioned before, age, ethnicity. Also, something I didn't mention before is that we can actually look at maybe ethnicity through the cranium, because different populations can have different morphological features. But also the cranium almost connects you to the individual you are studying. It puts almost a face to the bones you have in front of you. And obviously you can take this a step further. The cranium can even give, for example, facial reconstruction, something which is quite in trend now.
Done here in Malta.
Yes, exactly. Although there is some limitation, obviously. Sometimes you don't know what the color of the hair is or the eyes. But at least, you know, the cranium, I think, gives that connection for the osteologist to the human remains.
What about cultural activities? So far we've spoken about the individual's characteristics. But if you're looking, well, at an individual or perhaps even a larger group, what are the things that can tell you, the aspects of the bones that can tell you about cultural activities of the people you meet in these excavations?
Yes, definitely. The cultural activities, you can tell a lot from the bones about cultural activities. I mean, first of all, the skeleton is used as a tool, in the daily life of everyone. And therefore, what the constant actions that are done usually result in a bit of wear and tear on the skeleton itself, especially if there are repeated actions constantly being made. For instance, grooves on the teeth. Sometimes we find specific grooves on the teeth, which can indicate that the teeth were used as a tool, another hand, some people call them. And although it's trauma, so it's considered as trauma on the body, we can go further and study whether it was a repeated action or whether it's a one-off action which is causing that groove, for example, on the tooth. So we study it well. We look at even the direction of where that particular groove is or where the trauma is. And then we compare with other studies, anthropological studies. So we look at other societies, activities perhaps which we're not accustomed to today in our lifetime, but customs which have been done, which were done before, and also activities in our context as well. For instance, grooves could indicate a community which is processing hide, or else processing nets for fishing, for instance. It's something which in the past you used to see more of, perhaps in Marsa Shlok, where you see the fishermen using their mouths to adjust their nets or to fix their nets for fishing. So we look a lot at other examples, studies of other societies. But there also could be pathologies which could relate to wear and tear related to an activity, especially, for example, carrying of heavy objects on the back. That could result in specific pathology in the neck area. or the use of fingers, because you're doing something specialized, which can cause something like osteoarthritis. So it's very important that we study these different clues, and we research a lot about them.
Yes, I remember I had the privilege of working for a couple of seasons on the Shara Circle excavation in Gozo many, many years ago. And I was asked to work in one of the bone pits. And I remember the feeling of picking up the parts of not a whole skull, parts of the jaw, and looking at the teeth and seeing that the new teeth were growing from underneath and the baby teeth were still there. And it is nothing like that. As you say, you're looking at the face. And I thought, gosh, you know, this is a child that hasn't changed its teeth yet. And it was quite for me, it was quite an emotional moment, actually. So I can understand that really makes you feel close to who you're working with, which I think is important. But obviously, you're a scientist and you look at things clinically, but it's also nice to see these cultural and age-related things going on. I know that you've worked a lot on the bones in Malta, and perhaps through some examples of the work that you've done, you sort of tell us a little bit about the cultural activities that you've discovered and the other attributes of the bones that you looked at in the Maltese context.
Yes, I was very fortunate in these past few years to be also involved in large projects. For instance, one we've concluded recently was the ERC-funded Fraxos project, which was done with other collaboration with other universities, including that of Cambridge, Belfast, and even Malta. One of the aims of that project was to revisit the Shara Circle human remains, in fact, which had been excavated in the 80s and 90s. And we wanted to understand a bit more about how the humans in these prehistoric times were dealing with the changing environment around them. And one of the very key aspects of this assemblage was osteoarthritis, particularly in the hands, but also in the neck. Apart from the famous grooves I mentioned before on their teeth, their frontal teeth. What shocked me and also my colleague, Dr. Ronica Power, who worked extensively on the project, was that this population was so resilient that despite the pain it was getting from the osteoarthritis, they continued doing the repeated activity they were doing with their hands and also with their upper back. And the cushioning, that soft tissue between the joints and your fingers and your wrists, had deteriorated to the extent that there was none of it left. So there was bone-to-bone contact. And the bone becomes very polished, like you've put a layer of varnish on it. So that was very touching in the sense that, you know, you felt almost their pain through their work, a work which they felt was so important that they continued through the pain. But also this assemblage also gave a sense of care for the sick, for the elderly. Because in the assemblage, we found even evidence of very old individuals or people with physical limitations, people who broke their arm or their leg. And there is an attempt to help the fracture heal. And there is evidence that these people lived through very serious fractures. So I think that's we got out a lot from that study, but this was, I think, one of the highlights on the resilience of that community, even though we're talking about the prehistoric community. So we're talking 6,000, 5,000 years ago. I mean, all sites are quite exciting for me. It's not just the prehistoric sites, but it's even later. Right now, in fact, I'm about to continue my studies, hopefully in the Phoenician and Punic and Roman periods, because I think it's time that we start looking more about the data, the skeletal data from these periods as well. We've done a lot in the prehistoric period, and there's much more. But I think there's also something special going on with the Phoenician and later periods. And already we can start seeing that the trend is that there's still a very important aspect to these communities where they want to care for their dead. They are going through a lot of effort to rock cut these underground chambers, obviously using very primitive tools. And there is love and care given to these burials. So there's the burial of the skeleton, but also there are the objects associated with the burials. Sometimes you also get a bit more special burial. For instance, we've had newborns placed on plates, still put in the burial with the adults, but you can see that there's some special ritual associated to them and some special care. So I think this is what I get out from these burials, that humans were always caring for their community and for the dead. I think this is something we need to learn from these past communities as well. The care for others, which I think is very relevant to today's times.
Absolutely. And I believe you have a new skeleton to look at.
Yes.
SH has issued this very interesting video of how the tomb was recovered, really. Will you be working on that one?
Yes, right now, in fact, we're consolidating the bone, because unfortunately the bone had been waterlogged. There was some water intrusion which came in from this tomb in Rabat, which is a Phoenician tomb. But already we have some data. We already can tell that there are two individuals in this tomb, that we have a male and a female, which were lying next to each other. We're trying to understand whether they were buried together at the same time, or else there was one burial and then the second individual was placed in. And we also have interesting pathology coming up, especially with one individual. Hopefully we'll be able to tell a bit more. Right now we're trying to consolidate the bone so that we can handle it a bit better. But we're looking even into CT scanning some of the bone to look at the pathology a bit more. And there might be even some 3D printing of the bone, so that perhaps people can actually handle certain bones, not the original bone, but a replica, so that people can perhaps be even a bit more connected to the skeleton. After all, we all have skeletons. We just seem to be a bit disconnected sometimes, I feel.
Yes. Well, Campus FM listeners, you can say that you heard it here on the radio on Back in Time. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. I'd like to thank Bernadette Merici-Aspiteri for her very, very interesting explanation of skeletons today and bones in archaeology in general. Thank you so much. I'd just like to say to listeners, please join me next week. And we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.